CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The indictment of the former president of the United States by the special counsel, Mr. Smith. And I invite Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow writing and defining ideas and often podcasting. I recommend all of them to comment on what I have in my notes found to be four defenses anticipated by the president's counselors in trial that could be swift. In fact, the next hearing, I'm told, is at the end of August. Strange things happen in August. We come to three of these from the Wall Street Journal and the fourth from the Wall Street Journal. Richard, a very good evening to you. The events of these last days don't need an encapsulation. I'll just say the cliche is uncharted territory. I would say we're about to sail off the edge of the world into the unknown. So the first defense, the Wall Street Journal features in a headline. The question here is freedom of speech. That is expected to be the president's counselor's defense. The freedom of speech item, as I understand it, is First Amendment and the ability or willingness or embrace of ideas that are either inaccurate or hostile or dissenting is covered by the Constitution. How do you respond to the freedom of speech, to the First Amendment defense? Good evening to you.
I think what you have to do is to remember that this count, the indictment has four different counts. The first one is one of essentially a situation of defrauding the government and getting some tangible benefit. On that, the freedom of speech issue is utterly irrelevant. But at the same time, I regard that as a very weak count in the indictment, because you cannot sort of allege the return benefit that was received by the president or that he hoped to obtain. So I think that will go by the boards. And there's very little in the actual narrative which tends to support that. So I don't think it's a freedom of speech case. It's not very important. The two things that matter most are the question of trying to put the ersatz slate up there. And then the other thing is the question of what it is that you do to try to pressure various people to call for essentially a change. And, you know, freedom of speech is the right to engage in political debate. But at the same time, you have freedom of speech. You also have a crime known as conspiracy to overthrow the government by peaceful or other means. And those things are not going to be protected. And so if you start looking at what happened on this, if he starts to jawbone people in particular offices, it's not general public speech, it's specific. So already it's not part of the general public debate. And then what you have to do is to ask exactly what they said. The one most telling sentence in the indictment about that is when he started to approach the Secretary of State in Georgia and ask him to recount the ballots. He says, and if you don't do this, what's going to happen? There are going to be criminal charges that will be brought against you. It's hysterical on the one hand, but it's also a form of coercion on the other. And you cannot simply say when you're talking to your opponent in a various situation, I want you to know that I disagree with everything that you say. And if you start to announce it, I'm going to sue you and I'm going to indict you and I'm going to put you in jail. It's not protected speech. It's a threat. And so essentially the way to understand freedom of speech is like freedom of action. It's a presumption. It's not an absolute. And force and fraud and deception and so forth have never been covered by the document. So that's going to lose. And then on the third of these things, which you're asking about, which is the effort to set up the fake set of electors and to try to get the states to postpone, that's going to be just regarded as a good old-fashioned conspiracy whose object is essentially disrupt orderly election. And I don't think the freedom of speech defense gets even close to what's going on. One of the things that happens is if speech is legitimate in terms of its means and ends, the more people who participate in it, the more powerful. But the moment the ends are illegitimate and you get people combining to achieve them, what turns out to be protected speech now becomes a conspiracy, which is going to be criminal. And if you go back even to the days of the various kinds of communist conspiracies and so forth, there were large numbers of people who kept on talking about the importance of freedom of speech. The most noble of these situations, a case called Whitney against California, where Justice Brandeis gave this stirring situation about how freedom of speech is something which opens up the public to debate and honest discussion. What people should have understood was this was not a dissent against the conviction. It was a concurrence in the conviction for conspiracy, saying, but we have to be careful not to go too far. And so I think that the conspiracy charges will survive this. The only area where Trump, I think, can make a freedom of speech defense is one which I don't think he's going to be pressed very hard on. That's the January 6th stuff. What he did say is, let's go out there and show them. But what he also said is, we want to make a peaceful demonstration outside the Capitol building in order to influence people inside. So he did not say storm the gates, break into the building, or anything of that sort. And so that is probably going to be regarded as a protected speech. But what happens is, that's the weakest of the counts. If you'll note that what Smith did is, he called them rioters. He did not call them insurrectionists. And those are words which are freight with meaning, because if it's an insurrection, it could implicate the various provisions of the Equal Protection Clause and the Bill of Rights. I mean, you don't want to get, not the Bill of Rights, some Reconstruction Amendments. You don't want to get there. This is not the January 6th hearing where you start talking about everybody. It is probably not criminal to sit in front of a television and refuse to say anything, to call the mobsters off, or the gangsters off, or the rioters off, or whatever you wish to call them. So I think on that he has it. But this case is not going to turn on the defraud cases. It's not going to turn on January 6th. It's going to turn on the pressure on the one hand, on these various people, and the fake slate of electors on the other. And I think on those two areas, Trump is in deep trouble.
We turn to the second. This is the Wall Street Journal's identification in the front page, not the editorial page. The second possible defense is that his counselors advised him that he was within his rights to object to block, to in some fashion intervene in the normal business of the electors, and Congress vouchsafing the electors as emceed by the Vice President of the United States. Does that work, Richard? My lawyer told me.
Well, the answer is it can't work. Think of it this way. What happens is, you have a cockamamie scheme, and what you do is you turn to a point of lawyers and say, please tell me this is all right. You pick your favorite lawyers to issue your favorite opinion. If this is going to be an absolute defense, then everybody in the world will engage in opinion of counsel. But the opinion of counsel is, it's evidence that could be introduced, particularly if there's something in it that actually makes some sense, to indicate that he was in good faith. In this particular case, you have to see what the opinion of counsel was. You have to see whether it was plausible. You also have to recognize he gets opinion of one counsel, but there were 20 other people who were talking to him at the same time who gave him exactly the contrary opinions about what it was that he could and could not do. So if you're trying to figure out how this would come in on the two key counts that I've mentioned to you, the situation about trying to pressure Pence and so forth and form up the state electors and everybody else, opinion of counsel is essentially a very weak defense introduced at most to deal with mitigation. And under the circumstances of this particular case, where the president knew exactly who was going to sue and told them what to tell, and it can't possibly be an absolute defense. Otherwise, nobody could ever be guilty of any criminal charge.
In particular, there is an unnamed conspirator who the New York Times and others, the Wall Street Journal, have presumed to be John Eastman, his attorney. Mr. Eastman advances a theory that the vice president can intervene, can disrupt. Now, in the news in these last hours, the defense counsel for Mr. Trump, who's speaking on television, this was on Fox television within these last hours, recounts a meeting between the president and the vice president, and we can presume Mr. Eastman was present, but we don't know, in which the president pressures the vice president, and John Lauro, the attorney, puts it this way. What President Trump said is to the vice president, let's go with option D. Let's just halt. Let's just pause the voting and allow the state legislatures to take one last look and make a determination as to whether or not the elections were handled fairly, end quote. Richard, if John Eastman is the attorney advising this option D, is it credible, and can he blame John Eastman for giving him a bad idea?
Well, you can't get around all of this stuff. And in fact, what happens is, it's going to be interesting. Trump did not care in the slightest whether or not this was in good faith or in bad faith. He desperately wanted something to go, and it's another version of the opinion of counsel, and it's not going to work. The way the text is worded, it says it's open in the presence of everybody and you start to count. This does not sound like an ability where the ballots start to come in and you can demand that there be some kind of investigation before they could be approved. If you wanted to find that in the Constitution, there would have to be a whole variety of procedures to indicate the way in which it was done. And to simply say that you could turn it back to the states creates the following difficulties. Some will hear your creed, some will not. Some will try to postpone, some will not. You have a situation where you have a change in office as of January 20th, and there's no way on God's earth that you can actually run these proceedings within 2 or 3 weeks in order to make them work. And so it's an invitation for total chaos. It can't be right. And so I think what's going to happen is, you know, Eastman may believe this. He's a very able man, and he may try to defend it, but I don't think it's the kind of opinion on which Trump can rely. And I think, in effect, that he will basically be met with a barrage of opposition, saying, if you look at the structure and the context of this particular case, that cannot possibly be right, that you can do that. There's also something else here about the nature of the Constitution. It says that, you know, the electors to the Electoral College shall be chosen in such manner as the legislature of the state determines, right? Now, there's been a uniform practice, it's not written in the Constitution, and that says essentially what happens is you designate two electoral slates. They're all going to be bound electors so that they have no discretion if chosen. And the one who gets the majority of votes, it's their guys who go to the state college and so forth, right? What the position here says is, what as a legislature shall determine means that the state legislature can revoke the earlier decision under which the entire election was run and then substitute in a new set of rules at the 11th hour and 59th minute to do it. There's a huge customary constitution out there. Practices that are uniform and stable are generally going to be regarded as part of the basic document. And the thought that somehow or other one person under these extreme circumstances could blow everything up would be crazy. And mind you, suppose somebody else said, okay, you can do it this way. Well, there are several states that went kind of close to Donald Trump. We want to reexamine those too. And once you realize that the unilateral side can't be accepted and that the bilateral side is absolutely crazy, and then the answer is what this fellow has done is basically to make out the case for the government that there was a conscious effort to subvert the election. And it wasn't the device which says I'm going to cast the votes myself. But it turns out this alternative plan D is every bit as illegal as its plan A or plan B or plan C. And so essentially, if I were the plaintiff's lawyers, if I were the prosecutors in this particular case, I would say, well, here's what they said he wanted to do, and this is the thing that we said was illegal. We no longer have to prove it. We have an admission that this has, in fact, been done by the lawyer for the defendant. And so he should have not have said that thing. Probably he said it because it's true. And if that's his substantive defense, I think it's doomed.
Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution, writing at Defining Ideas, also a podcast on Defining Ideas I recommend. We're discussing right now what we know of the Wall Street Journal, a very good reporting organization, coming forward with possible defenses for the allegations brought forth in an indictment against the former president of the United States, Donald Trump. When we come back, 3 and 4. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.